In a time where social justice organizations are under attack, we bring you Rad Ops. That stands for Radical Operations. It's a dialogue-based tool that supports organizations assessing and discussing the possibilities and limitations of putting liberatory values into practice.
Many organizations are in turmoil as they pivot to meet this moment. RadOps offers principles, guiding questions, and tools that organizations can use to identify ways that they can and cannot practice liberatory values in this unjust world.
I'm one of your co-hosts, Yeshna Maya Padamsi.
And I'm your other co-host, Sha Grogan Brown. Together, we bring over 40 years of movement operations experience to inform these conversations. Our guest for this episode is Tara Shuai Ellison, who has dedicated her career to developing people, departments, and organizations to their fullest potential and greatest impact. With over two decades of nonprofit management, organizational development, human resources, operations, and financial manager experience in movements for social, racial, gender, LGBTQIA+, and economic justice, Tara loves helping nonprofits and the people powering them thrive to do their best work. Tara's had the privilege of working with some of the progressive movement's most innovative, rapidly growing nonprofits and foundations. She loves HR and ops nerdery and is a co-founder of RadOps, the online network, which we will be talking about. Tara is also a co-author of The Equitable Hiring Guide, a practical step-by-step guide for leaders who want to infuse equity into every aspect of their hiring. Tara founded Shuai Strategies in 2022 to work with more organizations to have a broader impact and to experiment with pushing the boundaries of traditional HR even further. Tara, we're so happy that you're joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yay! Welcome, Tara. We're so looking forward to talking with you about human resources, which is a huge umbrella, and all the twists and turns within that. Because of your experience and perspective from over 20 years of experience in this field, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you all so much. I'm really happy to be here and really excited to get into it.
Well, before we get started, I'm really excited to share with our audience that you and I worked together for over 5 years. I can't remember how many years, but it feels like maybe more like 10 years. but over 5 years at the National Domestic Workers Alliance, where we created the A-Team, which was our very cool name for the admin team. And together we helped build the infrastructure of the organization from where it started around 10 people to over 60 people. And I just wanted to name that for our audience that we have years and years of working together. And during that time, while we were at NDWA, alongside our comrades, Felicia Martinez and Mae Singerman, the four of us co-created Rad Ops, which is our online network that is now 10 years old. And we started this online network with, again, about 10, 20 people. Sha included was one of the first members of this online network. And now the group is over 900 people strong and still very active a decade later.
I know. It is wild that it's been a whole decade, right? And just really incredible, you know, to see the group still going strong and still a resource that people use, right? Whenever I mention Rad Ops, other HR and ops people are like, what? Yeah, that's amazing. So I'm just really proud of what we built and the legacy that continues on.
Yeah, I'm also so glad that, you know, we're starting with the lineage of Rad Ops with you, Tara, and sort of the framework and network that really made way for this project and this podcast. And I know just for me, that network of folks has been such a huge source of peer-to-peer grappling and troubleshooting, ideation, like asking each other questions, finding solutions when we couldn't find them elsewhere over the past decade. And so I'm just really honored to be part of building out this era of RadOps through this project. And as you know, we are building this RadOps lineage timeline. And as we've mentioned, you, Felicia, Yashna, and May are all on that timeline as co-founders of the RadOps Network. And so I wanted to ask you, our first question is just when you think back to like those early days of when you were coming up with the term and the framework of RadOps, what was a lineage that was informing your approach? And you can think back to then and also who you might want to name and honor now.
Yeah, you know, we did such powerful work when we were together at NDWA. And at the time, NDWA's tagline thing that we always said was domestic work is the work that makes all other work possible. And, you know, after a few years and building out the team, we were like, wait, but that's us too, right? So we started saying, you know, about the HR, ops, finance, and events work that we were all doing, that our work was the work that made all the other work of the organization possible. And so both that framework and the work that we did at NDWA really seeded that lineage, right? Because I think also at the time in 2016, there really weren't many at all, like maybe one or two other resources for values-aligned HR, ops, finance, events professionals doing work in the progressive movement and how we could do things different and better in a values-aligned way. And so there was just this real gap, right? So we thought like, okay, you know, let's build a group where we can actually share resources rather than having to, you know, call our peers one by one to see like, hey, do you have a recommendation for this or that? And so that, you know, that need and that gap that we saw and that we experienced was really what birthed RadOps.
Love it. And Yashna and I have talked about in other episodes that some of like early days of us working together was calling each other, like phone a friend. Hey, I'm trying to figure this out. What have you figured out? Let's troubleshoot this. And having that network has just expanded that practice for so many folks. Okay. And then I guess I want to invite you to say a little more also just about yourself and, you know, what types of RadOps roles you've played. I know there are so many, whatever you want to name, and just what would you name as your personal operations route of how you got into this work?
Well, so Tara Shui Ellison, she, her pronouns. I'm a Taiwanese biracial queer femme who was raised in Richmond, Virginia. I lived up and down the East Coast, and I'm now based in Los Angeles. And like you all said, I've been doing, you know, HR, OD, operations, and finance roles in movement for the past 20 plus years. I've been an admin assistant. I've been a deputy director, an interim ED twice, and really everything in between. And I've been at orgs as small as five and as large as 100, right? And now I am the founder and a consultant at Shui Strategies. We are an equity-centered HR and OD consulting firm, and we utilize emergent learning and a both-hand approach to both support progressive and radical organizations who are making meaningful change in the world, as well as the hardworking people who power them. And, you know, I didn't really start off my career looking for this kind of work. It found me. You know, I've been in the workforce for over three decades at this point and, you know, had many, many different jobs. The first decade of my work was in the service sector. And so I was a fast food worker, a retail employee, a sex worker, a telemarketer, a waitress, and more. And, you know, for much of that time, I was also involved in queer liberation and fat liberation work. And so I wanted very badly to work in movement, but just didn't know where I fit in. And so, you know, I started my work doing admin work, right? That was the first job I was able to get in movement. And, you know, over time, my roles kept expanding to add in HR and finance. And at some point I realized like, oh, actually I'm kind of good at this stuff and I like it too, right? And so when I actually started doing human resources, because I had a decade of really bad jobs, I wanted to do something different and I wanted to do something better. And so I took that opportunity and ran with it.
I really love that. And I'm guessing a lot of folks listening to this will hear themselves in some of your story, because I've heard this also from so many people that they're like, I really wanted to get involved with social justice work. I couldn't figure out what was the right role. And then I realized I was really good at this operations thing and they needed some more operations. And so I entered in that way. So it's such a, I think that legacy that you're naming also, I've heard resonate with a lot of folks that are doing operations work in our movement. So thank you for walking that through with us. And then my last question before I pass it to Yashna, you know, we are going to have some more detailed questions for you, but we wanted to give you a chance at the start here before we get really into things, in the spirit of, like, you know, no one size fits all. There's no one perfect answer to any situation. What would you say is your current political landscape read for human resources work or any of the other work areas you want to talk about? In particular, like, big lessons learned or assessments that you're making at this moment around human resources that you think are kind of fundamental big picture things before we tackle the zoomed in questions, or things that we might want to ground in before we go zoomed in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. And, you know, let's start here. I don't know a single person who is happy to be clocking into work under capitalism in these conditions, right? And as an HR person, sometimes whose job is to, you know, I literally had a job put on my job description that my job was to make a happy workplace, right? And so, you know, I work with a lot of organizational leaders in my consulting practice now, and so many of them are coming to me with anxiety about the fact that their staff morale is so low. And my response has become like, well, yeah, that makes sense, right? Who among us is happy to be clocking into work while fascists continue to kill our people and unravel civil society, right? You know, and we as HR and operations folks, we can and should do what we can to make our workplaces better and more values aligned, but we can't fix the harm of the external world in a workplace, right? And I think we also always have to keep in mind that nonprofit organizations are one vehicle for change among many, right? And as I'm sure you all have talked about here, there are legal limits, resource constraints, and we're all staffed by humans, right? So we can't expect a 501c3 to make us happy and meet all of our needs. You know, another big picture trend that I see that myself and so many others are trying to navigate are really deep generational shifts around ideas about what our employers owe us and what we owe our employers, right? And the boundaries of that are really changing in so many ways of what's expected and what's right. And so I see the ways that those changing and sometimes really fuzzy boundaries causing a lot of friction and frustration for staff and for the people who are trying to be in leadership right now.
Thank you so much for that. The thing that you said about the charge of, like, it's your job to make this a happy workplace, you know, no pressure, but like, the world's falling apart, but everyone needs to be happy here, right? That just feels, yeah, the way you put that is so clear. That's like that's a tough task and maybe unrealistic one. So thanks for lifting that up.
You know, and the funny thing about that was that job I started on March 9th, 2020, right? And so it was just like, it's like I came in thinking that I was ready to take it on and, you know, make the best workplace anyone had ever seen. And then, you know, something else happened, right? Like, we learned a whole lot in March 2020 and beyond about what our workplaces could and couldn't do for us.
I really appreciate that and you naming that, and also just even using the terms employer or workplace. In the movement, we talk a lot about organizations and organizations being a vehicle for our movement work. And the reality is, because we are often under a 501c3 nonprofit context, these organizations are also employers. They are workplaces. And just to know that organizations can be rich with movement culture and also have the construct of being a workplace and an employer, and navigating that as an HR person, that just is so complicated, and really as any worker within this workforce. So again, thanks just for naming that nuance and clarity around that. You know, going a little further into some of this, a lot of this context that you're naming and our work together has helped inform the 8 principles that we've put together in this RADOPS framework. And wanted to ask you, which of these RADOPS principles resonate or have been a guiding force for you and your approach to the work?
Well, I mean, all of them, for sure, right? And especially because we you know, kind of collaborated to build these out as well. But the one that I, you know, I'll talk about today is, you know, a core competency I believe that all of us are really going to need to skill up in this time in particular is, you know, navigating complexity, uncertainty, and holding multiple truths and sometimes diametrically opposing truths, right? For example, I believe that under capitalism, exchanging labor for livelihood is inherently exploitative and ableist, right? That is just true. Yet I also do HR work from an equity and justice framework because I know that despite its many imperfections, we as employers can do better even under oppressive conditions. And, you know, I don't know if you all are familiar with the Instagram account Vent Diagrams. It's a collaborative social media and art project. I know, it's so good. And so they're pictures of Venn diagrams that they call Vent diagrams. And they each of them contain statements that, you know, are both true and contradictory. So for example, having power is liberating and having power is terrifying. Mm. You know, balancing the long game with everything is urgent, right? And, you know, they very purposefully don't label that middle, you know, so that we can keep imagining and acting from the intersections and the overlaps. And I feel like us as, you know, HR ops, finance folks in movement organizations, we're always trying to find that middle space. And so that really resonates for me now more than ever is, you know, we try to seek joy in chaos as we try to imagine how to do things better while knowing that we can't create utopias in a 501c3 construct. And as we all try to really stretch ourselves to hold just the hugeness of our world's glaring contradictions.
Yeah, I think another thing I've like that you named earlier that circles back to this is you named like working with organizations and the people who power them. And that if we really look at that, also deconstructing that people power organizations, including the leaders of an organization, are often folks who came from movement work, just like the line staff. And so just complicating that too, that we're all people within the structure of an organization. No one person can represent the organization, but that we're all powering it from a different angle. So just wanted to, again, that's the duality that you're talking about, or breaking the duality that you're talking about, that there is that in-between space too. So
yeah, that was also making me think about when we were talking with you last summer about kind of these principles that we articulated. You know, there this one that you named around embracing contradictions also, you know, you showed us the Venn diagrams then, and I've can't stop thinking about it since then, and seeing what we're, you know, there's a whole section of our workbook that's about like false binaries and contradictions and the space in between. And so just that'll be in the notes for this episode, but there's resources folks can use to even just help identify what are those places where we're like talking at each other across what feels like a divide and forgetting about like this could all be true at the same time. So, you know, this might be leading, but if you, our next question is sort of, if you were going to name, like within the work that you're doing around operations, human resources, topics of conversation that you think kind of get the most airtime or that are most live questions for movement operation folks in these times, what would those be?
Yeah, great question. Let's talk about power dynamics. Because that is a term that I hear almost every day in my work, right? You know, one of the issues that I feel like we are all trying to think about and navigate is how to navigate complex power dynamics externally for sure, but also internally. And that's where, from my perspective, right, as an HR person, hear about it most. In particular, around the false binary, like we said, of management versus non-management staff, right? Which is both real and not real, right? And one of the ways that I have seen this just surface over and over again is hearing staff say that, you know, they feel like they can't give feedback to each other or to people who have more power than them organizationally in a hierarchical structure, that is inherently safe. And so it's just not doable, right? And so from my perspective, right, while the management versus non-management staff power dynamic is very, very real, I've been on both sides of it, right? My experience tells me that power dynamics exist regardless of organizational form and outside of organizations in general, right? And I say this, you know, from the place of someone who, you know, has both privileged and marginalized identities, as someone who, again, has been in positions with and without formal organizational power, you know, and then someone who's also worked in both hierarchies and consensus-based flat structures. A little story I like to tell, a couple of years ago in my consulting practice, I was working with a worker co-op, right? So they were a flat structure and they were really struggling with building their feedback culture. And so I did one-to-ones with all of the worker owners asking them, you know, what do you feel like is getting in the way of you giving and receiving feedback? And every single one of them named power dynamics as a barrier, right? And it was just this aha moment. Not like I didn't know it before, but the moment that I needed to bring that clarity, like, yeah, this exists regardless of whether you have a hierarchy or flat structure, right? Management versus non-management is really just one layer of power on top of all the other power differentials that exist between us because of, you know, identity things like race, class, gender, sexuality, but also power differentials that exist due to things like tenure, charisma, your sphere of influence, and knowledge or expertise, just to name a few, right? And so when we try to either act like power isn't impacting our relationships and our orgs, or when we legitimize the belief that organizational hierarchy is the only power operating in a space, it just creates so much friction and frustration. And so I just, you know, I really believe that in our movement spaces, we need to build our skills to really name and navigate complex power dynamics.
Yeah, I'm like buzzing about this right now. I think some of the stuff you named around feedback culture and then this, what we bring in from our lived experiences in the world, right, of positional power, but then how big those can start to feel. And I, you know, we've all worked with Raquel Avina, who's going to be on this podcast as well. And she also has talked about like there's positional power and then there's also power of influence and that both of those can be at play in an organization's culture. And I'm curious mm-hmm. what you would say about like what you've seen in terms of both this kind of like, I can't speak because of positional power, but then also how does the power of influence play out inside organizations as well?
Yeah, well, I also want to credit Raquel and NDWA because I really remember the first time we had that conversation organizationally about the many different spheres of power. And this was also in an external context, though, right? We talked about power in that way, too. But I think it was really the first seed of me trying to think about power in a way more complex way. And, you know, obviously now have utilized that to really think about internal power dynamics. And, you know, as someone, I mostly work with small to medium organizations, so between like 5 and 50 staff. And particularly when you're in a movement organization and you're that small, one person's voice can make such a difference, right? Even if you are at the, you know, bottom of the hierarchy, you know, someone who has something important to say, like I've seen that sway organizational policy, culture, the vibe in the room, right? There's so many ways that individual people can and do impact what organizations are doing. And that's, you know, particularly true from what I've seen in the small to medium sized nonprofit space.
I love this. Thank you for naming it. I feel like this whole episode, you just keep naming things directly that we just really need to be talking about. So thank you for naming power dynamics. And you said that you feel like it's really important for our social justice nonprofit spaces to build this skill in how we navigate complex power dynamics. So can you give us some examples of how you think we can build the skill?
Yeah, I think there's both individual and institutional levels to this, right? So individually, I can share that, you know, I was raised in a very conflict averse, we don't talk about feelings or give feedback, maybe we receive feedback. and so for me, it took a very intentional and purposeful commitment to building up my skill in that. And that's not something we can do for people. It's a choice that people have to make for themselves. However, I will say institutionally, you know, there are ways that we already build the skill in different contexts, right? So for example, we skill up our organizers to speak to folks who have more and less power than they do, right? Our organizers are talking to elected officials and community members to win campaigns and change legislation. We also ask our fundraising staff to speak to funders, right, who have more power than us due to access to money and resources. And, you know, in both of these examples, we often ask our staff to navigate that power differential by building on our shared values and our common goals rather than seeing us versus them, right? Mm-hmm. You know, but that's something that we as organizational leaders, myself included, really struggle to figure out how to navigate internally, particularly folks who are really, you know, wedded to the idea of this binary of, you know, management versus non-management. And so I just believe that we have the capacity and we already have the knowledge to build those skills. We just need to do better at building those internally and translating those lessons that we give to our organizers and our fundraisers and other folks to be able to do that internally.
You know, I think about this also too, with people who do fundraising, you know, and I've done a lot of resource mobilization over my career and worked with a lot of really powerful organizers who, like you said, they can go speak in the face of a legislator and call on them to do what's right. You know, they can show up to a meeting and motivate hundreds of people to take action. And then somehow when they're in a room with a funder, it's like this deflation and almost like, you know, it's a, like the confidence is masked or like it's really different, which makes sense because there is a lot of power in people who make decisions about resourcing, but it is, I think it is a thing for many operations workers, you know, that it's like a skill to keep building up. Like we know what we're talking about and we have the right to be righteous and visionary and also like, name what needs to happen in whatever room we're in. So just that, yeah, you're making me think about how I've seen that also play out in the sort of fundraising realm too.
Yeah. And I think we're all also bringing our own experiences to our workplaces, right? And so a parallel I can think of is when I'm speaking with someone one-on-one, two-on-one, like this space, I feel very at ease, but I am terrified of public speaking. Like getting in front of a live audience is just like fills me with dread, right? And so it's just like we're all bringing in our stuff into the workplace. And, you know, this is where I was saying the work is also internal and individual, right? Because the folks that you're thinking about who are organizers who can speak truth to power in front of, you know, legislators or members, but who, you know, have stuff in front of a funder, like it makes sense. And, you know, there's just so much stuff that we're all bringing to the workplace.
Yeah, I really liked how you said it has to be each individual's choice and in their own agency if this is something they want to do or not. So I appreciate you starting there and also recognizing what are the conditions of the organization you're in and is speaking truth, is reaching out to leaders invited, you know, and welcome in this type of organization. So I think those are definitely important factors to think about. And then I think also what we were saying earlier of the organization, especially in movement spaces, can be held as a family space. I know I've heard a lot of people being like, we're all family here. And even in our families, there's so many power dynamics and it's hard to speak up sometimes. And so whether you're holding your organization as a family or whether you're holding it as an employer and workplace or somewhere in between, any of those spheres are going to be hard to speak up with power dynamics. And so again, just appreciating you naming it and knowing that each organization and each context may be a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. And to that point, you know, I think it's really important that organizations make the conditions of their workplace really clear, utilizing consent-based communication. So one way that I do that is when I'm doing my hiring work with clients is to think through like, okay, what are the conditions people are walking into? How are we portraying that in both the job description as well as during the interview process? And at the end of an initial interview, I'll name like, here are some of the conditions, here's the salary, here's the travel requirement, et cetera, et cetera. And then I'll say, do these conditions work for you? Right. And so I feel like that's one thing we can do as institutions, as organizations, to make it clear what our expectations are, including if, you know, you have an expectation internally that people work on their giving and receiving feedback skill. That's an important expectation because not everyone is up for that work, right? Or for example, if, you know, someone doesn't want to work in a hierarchy, that is okay. But if your organization is a hierarchy and intends to stay that way, that should be clear. And then it's possible that your workplace is not a good fit for them, which is also okay.
I love that. As much clarity upfront as possible is so essential. I know we did this work together at NDWA as well, as really think through the onboarding experience. And so, yes, consent-based communication before someone is hired, but also once they're hired, taking time. I know a lot of jobs are hit the ground running, but it's worth it to take the time, even if the onboarding is over a period of time, to make sure folks know what they're coming into, what type of organizational culture, what are the collective agreements, so that there's continual consent along the way and space for them to also help shape it now that they're new and coming back in. So big on onboarding.
And also that speaks to the amount of power, right, that even a brand new person can have in organizations, right? They can help spot the gaps and help you figure out like, okay, how can we do this better, right? That this, you know, something like onboarding should be an evolving process that continues to really bring people into the organization.
I have a follow-up question about, and I'm sort of thinking back to like when you named, I'm still sitting with this, like your charge is to make this workplace happy. So, you know, what do you do with that? I'm just like, if you can share a little more, how have you over time kind of gotten to where you are now with finding the nuance in that? Or, you know, because obviously we care about people's happiness. I'm sure you want people to be happy and do that in the ways that we can, but also what you are naming, you know, for anybody out there listening who might also be like, I'm supposed to do that too. What are my choice points here? What are the trade-offs? I don't know, just any advice you would offer. You've said a little bit, but what advice would you offer to folks that are kind of like, I want my workplace to be happy. I feel saddled with that charge. The world's on fire. Like, what's the right size thing I can do here?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think a few things. One, I think having an assessment of your sphere of influence, right? That, like you said, different workplaces are going to be different. And so maybe I'm in a workplace where they're really looking for me to do a major overhaul and change everything. And then I can do some work to really build out processes and tools that I think are really going to support this workplace to build the conditions that make it easier to thrive. I think another frame that I think about actually when we were writing the description for Rad Ops initially, the framework we came up with is we are building the container and it is your job to fill it. Right. And so I think about that as well, right? That it is our job as, you know, infrastructure professionals to build the kind of container that is most likely to support people to thrive, including supports along the way, right? It's not just like, here's the best policy in the world. Now we're a great workplace. It's also building the supportive structures to make those values real. But I think, yeah, I mean, and you know, I say this and I also struggle with it myself. I think less as a consultant because now I come into organizations with a very specific task to help with a very specific piece. I think, you know, my struggle when I was a deputy director, head of HR was harder because I think the temptation or the desire is to want everyone to be happy and thriving. And so, you know, that for me was just a lot of personal work around trying to figure out like, okay, what is actually the scope of my responsibility and my sphere of influence? And where is, you know, where do I need to let that go? And that's really difficult work.
What about you, Yeshna? I feel like you might have also grappled with this question over time.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think I you know, very aligned with what Tara just laid out. And something that makes me think of is also, what is the definition of happiness within this organization and with this group of, with this team or with this group of workers? And can we get on the same page of, on that of, okay, what does happy mean to this team? And what, and then doing that extra step of like, this is actually what the organization can meet around this definition. And this is what we can't. And so I think getting on the same page of that. So then when someone like Tara comes in this position, then there's clarity for and guidance for what this role could actually do or not do. Yeah. Well, we have so much here, and I'm so glad we covered everything we covered, and there's so much more. I think thinking about happiness, we go to our happy corner of the podcast, which is the speed round. Sean, are going to ask you some questions, Tara. First thought, best thought, whatever is at the top of mind can come out. Speed round. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. First one, spreadsheets or Post-its?
Oh, I am a spreadsheet nerd for life. I'm with you. I have a full thing of Post-its on my desk that I don't think I've used one in like 6 months. So that tells you anything.
This follows it. Maybe, but second one, notes, digital or analog?
Yeah, I can type way faster than I can write. So digital notes always.
Mm-hmm. All right. Text, phone call, or voice note?
I think text if it's quick, and a voice note if I have a soliloquy to deliver.
I welcome a soliloquy anytime.
Same. I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, send me your soliloquies.
Okay, this one's a little contentious, but receipts. Do you keep them or toss them?
Well, as a former finance director, the receipts get kept, they get filed. The problem is throwing them away.
That makes sense. So, shout out an org or an ops person you are loving right now.
Yeah, there's so many, but I always love the opportunity to shout out my business partner and co-collaborator, Casey Amon Wilson. She is a brilliant powerhouse badass who, in addition to consulting with me on HR and OD at Schwy Strategies, is also the COO and co-founder of New Disabled South, the nation's first regional disability justice organization. Her and I have an incredible working relationship. We work together at that happy workplace and loved working together so much that we decided to keep doing it. So she is also one of the co-authors of the Equitable Hiring Guide. And last year we did a couple of webinars, including one called Be Strategic, Not Scared, that actually touched on several of the points that I shouted out today. So, you know, her and I just have an incredible working relationship, and I feel really lucky to call her both a thought partner and a co-collaborator.
That's awesome. We'll put all of those resources in the show notes too. So thanks for shouting them out now. Oh, that's awesome. I'm excited to look up all of those resources and organizations.
Same. Okay, next question. What song do you put on to set the tone for a meeting or a session?
I think it depends on the type of meeting, but I actually have a Zoom Jams playlist, and the first song on it is, is I Wish You Roses by Kali Uchis.
Ooh. Nice. And what is the soundtrack for your operations work?
Yeah, well, like I said, I have a Zoom Jams playlist, but you know, I don't know, give me a moody song with a good beat, and that helps to get my work done.
I love it.
I wanted to ask you this one before, but I held off because I knew we were going to ask you now. But when you envision the future of movement operations, what are three words you would use to describe it?
The Movement Operations Future I Want to Femifest is building, connecting, and thriving.
Yes, Femifest. And what is one wish you have for Movement Operations people in this moment?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I really want us to believe in our power to transform our collective imaginations into tangible realities, right? I want us to be the alchemists who turn what if into what is, you know, because that is our superpower and our legacy.
Turn what if into what is. Be the builders. I love that.
Writing that one down.
Definitely. Thank you so much, Tara. I'm so, so happy you joined us today. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's always good to talk to you all and nerd out about this because, yeah, this is our work. This is our superpower.
That's right. We hope you enjoyed the show. You can subscribe and listen to more episodes wherever you find podcasts. Check out the additional resources from each episode in the show notes and take it all back to dialogue with your teams about building adaptable and values-aligned infrastructure. You'll also find links there to subscribe to the RadOps Substack, where you'll get the latest updates and resources.
This show is produced by Josh Elstro and published by Convergence Magazine. Design support from Kimmy David. Music by Tiger Cat, my amazing 10-year-old, with Polish by Josh. And remember,
keep it rad, y'all.